You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC Boston College. Today is Sunday, April 19th, 2026. Before we step into this hour, a brief reminder for our listeners. The reflections you hear tonight belong solely to our hosts and guests. They do not necessarily represent the views of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You're tuned in to This Week in Palestine, a place where truth is not whispered, not softened, not trimmed to fit the comfort of the powerful. This is a space where truth walks in with its full weight, where urgency is not optional, where clarity is not negotiable. Wherever you are driving through the long stretch of night, stirring your first cup of coffee at dawn, or listening quietly in the stillness of your home, thank you for choosing to be here. I'm your host and narrator, Bethany Marks. On this program, we do not polish the edges of reality. We do not rewrite the story to make it easier to swallow. We do not trade honesty for politeness. This is a place where truth arrives unfiltered, where resistance is not a metaphor, but a lived experience, where solidarity is not a slogan, but a lineage carried through generations, where the voices rising from the heart of occupation are not faint, not isolated, not swallowed by empire. They rise together steady, unbroken, standing shoulder to shoulder with movements across the world that demand dignity, justice, and liberation for all people. This hour is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth fighting for. Even in the deepest darkness, the ember of defiance refuses to die. Each week, we bring you reporting that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften. We do not dilute. We speak with intention because the stakes are far too high for anything less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without hesitation. Because the struggle for liberation does not belong to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred. How is the West accepting genocide in Palestine, Lebanon, and Iran? How is Israel justifying killing Palestinians? Simply by calling them Muslims. As if a single word could erase humanity, erase history, erase the right to live. Today, we begin with that question. A question that cuts through every headline, every press conference, every carefully crafted political statement. A question that exposes the machinery of dehumanization. The way entire nations are reduced to labels. The way entire peoples are stripped of their stories. Their dignity. Their breath. Because when you call a people Muslims, instead of calling them human beings, mothers, fathers, children, students, workers, dreamers, you make it easier to justify their suffering. You make it easier to ignore their deaths. You make it easier to turn away. And while this narrative spreads, another one grows quietly in the background. The idea that the war on Islam is somehow separate from the war on ordinary people. But as filmmaker Matthew Cook argues in his video, why this war on Islam is a war on you. The fear-based messaging we see online is not organic. It is not accidental. It is not spontaneous. It is engineered, funded by powerful interests who benefit when the public is divided, distracted, and afraid. Matthew Cook argues that anti-Islam narratives are part of a larger political strategy, a strategy that uses fear to manipulate voters, redirect attention, and justify policies that harm everyday Americans. He explains how the same groups pushing anti-Sharia legislation are often the ones undermining social programs, blocking healthcare reform, and cutting education budgets. He breaks down how misinformation about Islam becomes a tool not just to target Muslims, but to weaken the public's ability to see who is actually shaping their lives. And that's the heart of tonight's conversation. When fear is manufactured, who profits? When hatred is amplified, who gains power? When truth is distorted, who gets to rewrite reality? Because the war on Islam, as Cook frames it, is not just about religion. It is about control. It is about distraction. It is about keeping people focused on an invented enemy so they never look up and ask the real questions. Why is healthcare unaffordable? Why are wages stagnant? Why are schools underfunded? Why are wars endless? Why are billions spent on destruction while millions struggle to survive? And when we look at Palestine, Lebanon, Iran, when we look at the way suffering is justified, minimized, or erased, we see how powerful narratives can be. We see how language becomes a weapon. We see how entire populations can be dehumanized with a single word. Today, we peel back that narrative. We examine how fear is manufactured. We explore how propaganda becomes policy. And we ask what it means for all of us, Muslims, Christians, Jews, atheists, Americans, Palestinians, and every community caught in the crossfire of political agendas. Because if a war can be justified by a label, then no one is safe from being labeled next. This is This Week in Palestine. And now, we begin with the truth behind the stories we are told and the stories we are never meant to question. Let's listen together.
The war on Islam is a war on you. This industrial scale, billionaire-funded campaign that's been running decade after decade, demonizing Muslims and Islam. It's so sophisticated. It's comprehensive, covering legacy media, all these paid personalities and politicians, providing ideological cover for what is now the most extensively documented genocidal campaign in modern history. 2.5 years of public human sacrifice, and people brag about it, about rites of conquest. People still rooting for it. The 5 to 6 million people bombed out of their homes, a civilian death toll well over 100,000. And the target of all the propaganda is you. The 20-year failure of Afghanistan that cost $2.3 trillion. That money didn't just disappear. It went to arms dealers and mercenaries and political campaigns and contractors and construction companies. That catastrophic criminal failure in Iraq, that cost at least another $3 trillion. That intervention in Libya, spearheaded by Hillary Clinton, that was another $1.5 billion turning a thriving nation into an open slave state. All that money went into making a small group of people very rich. And now another Hague-worthy bombing campaign of Iran, destroying the global economy so that this Israeli ethnic cleansing operation can continue without resistance, that's killing thousands of civilians, all for the low, low price of $50 billion to kick things off, plus another $2 billion a day. What do we think this is all for? It's not about saving Western civilization or keeping anybody safe. If we wanted that, we would have paid for universal health care for every U.S. citizen, public college for every student for a decade. 1 million toddlers could have gotten child care That's enough to have rebuilt every school, every road, every bridge, every hospital that's crumbled since Reagan. There would have been enough left over to feed the whole planet by now. Deploying housing models everywhere, solving this migration crisis we pretend to care about. Western civilization? This is a totally imaginary idea. There is no West without East. This is a flat Earth concept. Christianity itself is a Middle Eastern religion. Philosophy, math, science, astronomy, medicine, all came out of Africa. All the technologies that human beings have developed have been created on a planet whose cultures all interact like water, ever changing and moving and growing and reshaping each other. There is no such thing as Judeo-Christian values that exist somehow in opposition to Islamic values. This is the same religion. And if you practice any of those religions, you're going to use the same word for God as long as you speak the same language. You'll use the same phrase for saying hello, peace be upon you. Half the population of the whole planet practices an offshoot of one of these three branches of one religion of Abraham, which has one core teaching. When a stranger joins you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. There is no East versus West, except in a horror cartoon written to bring about the end of humanity, the species, and the quality. So when you look at the USA or any European nation or any of its colonies, which are some of the most heavily propagandized societies on Earth, but particularly the USA, when you read over all those anti-Sharia bills, which would take you days because there are now over 200 of them that have been introduced in 43 of the United States, if you read them and you know anything about this planet you live on, you'll see their purpose is not to protect people from religious extremism. It has been to spread it. The man who designed this anti-Sharia campaign, David Yerushalmi, he was the senior policy research director of, guess, a neoconservative Israeli think tank. This is a guy who actively promotes the ethnic cleansing of Arabs, the deportation of Muslims, and the vilification of Islam. He's publicly admitted the purpose isn't actually to pass laws, but to get press on the word Sharia. Not honest press. Total propaganda. The core claims of this anti-Sharia movement are that Sharia is a plot to overthrow the government. Totally ridiculous, as we will cover shortly. But meanwhile, Israeli hardliners like him do seem to control U.S. foreign policy, clearly. The anti-Sharia campaign claims that more than 80% of mosques are terror training grounds. Well, that's been thoroughly debunked by our own FBI, by a 2010 Rand Corporation study, which really looked into it and found the number of radicals among Muslims in the United States is, quote, tiny, less than one in 30,000 people. Meanwhile, there appear to be churches and synagogues all over the United States openly fundraising for the violent seizure of Palestinian homes, tax-deductible and subsidized by the American taxpayer. That David guy claims that Sharia courts are replacing American law. Yeah, there's not a single instance of that, but 38 states have passed laws and executive orders designed to shut down any boycotts of Israel. So it becomes really clear what this psychological operation to demonize Islam is all about, because the people of Palestine, whose families have lived on that land since the Canaanites. This is one of the most continuous populations on earth. These are peoples whose ancestors practiced all these religions, Christianity and Judaism, but because most became Muslims centuries ago, they're now being cast as monsters. Otherwise, how else could they be deprived of all their basic human rights, including the right to just exist? This could not happen without the total vilification of Islam. The entire region could not be constantly invaded, leaders overthrown, extremist dictators, monarchs, monsters installed and protected by the West. None of that could happen without the vilification of Islam. And where there is radicalization, every serious study points to the same root cause: U.S., European, and Israeli military intervention in Muslim-majority countries, including occupied Palestine. So what is this Sharia that they want to outlaw? The word means the way. It refers to a person's religious practice. It's comparable to an English Christian phrase like following scripture or canon law or following the Dharma. If you're a Buddhist, Dharma means path or the teaching. Sharia means the same thing, the path. But there is enormous depth in this concept because the word Sharia refers to only the first level of the path, the physical level. Like the Sharia of Christmas or the way of Christmas might include decorating a tree in December, but there's a level deeper that's sometimes called the Tariqa or the Tariqa, the meaning of the path. You might decorate a tree, but never know the meaning. The Tariqa means understanding the giving spirit of Christmas, or the origin of lights on a tree, which some say represents that there's always light, even in the darkness. A deeper level still beyond Sharia, beyond Tariqa, is sometimes called the Hakika, the experience of the path, the real content, as in experiencing the generosity and spirit of Christmas, like the redemption story of Scrooge in A Christmas Carol, when he experiences that the meaning of life is not the acquisition of real estate or material things at the expense of others, because that corrupts the content of your own character, because you took the wrong path. So now that we understand the word Sharia, outlawing the way that you get married or perform funeral rites or pray to the Almighty or ask forgiveness, outlawing that, that's what they want to outlaw. So there are multiple passages in both the New Testament and the Torah that explicitly chastise any who condemn others for their path, their way of worship. In the biblical story of Jesus Christ, for example, he calls the Pharisees hypocrites 7 times in 1 chapter for that kind of judgmental nonsense. So why ban Sharia then, if it makes no sense, if it's anti-Judeo, anti-Christian? Because by banning the path, the outward Sharia, the state criminalizes the whole spiritual journey called Islam, the religion itself, its people. It turns it into a political movement. And if one truly understands the word Islam, which means total surrender to the Almighty, anti-Sharia law makes that illegal. So the demand is the worship of the state. So if anyone's still wondering what entity best resembles the Antichrist, that is it. And so remember that when you hear paid personalities like Sam Harris on Bill Maher's show say Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas, and watch Bill Maher agree. Or when the Tennessee rep says Muslims don't belong in American society. Or when you see that Florida rep say we need more Islamophobia, not less. And that the choice between dogs and Muslims is not a difficult one. When you see that Texas rep say how many Americans need to get Allahu Akbar'd before we realize Islam is a problem. When you see that Wisconsin rep just flat out lying, saying that it's indisputable that there are radical Muslim sleeper cells here in America murdering American citizens. When we see the Alabama rep saying that Muslims are the enemy inside the gate. When we see that there's now a Sharia-Free America caucus, a congressional body with 59 members across 24 states, whose mission is to save Western civilization. Understand that this is the extremist religious movement afoot, a massive, sinister social engineering campaign whose participants fully include the New York Times, CNN, every corporate media outlet that profits from permanent war and serves a ruling class who operate outside of all laws and ethics. And so when they say that the Middle East has been at war for thousands of years, understand that is a manufactured myth designed to make current events and current violence seem normal and inevitable. In reality, the longest periods of coexistence between the three branches of the religion of Abraham have historically been under Muslim governance, from Umar's Jerusalem to Saladin to the Ottoman community system, administrations that were guaranteeing freedom of worship, freedom of the path. The point here is not to elevate one group of people and imagine that they're different from another. Our ideologies, our ideas, are as unique as each individual who practices them. And the word Islam actually means surrendering our ideas, the forms, the idols, the images in our head. Islam was originated as a reform movement within the religion and the traditions of Abraham, each of whose branches sprung from the same root, whose offshoots all aimed at the same sunlight. What the warmongers from the far, far west and their propagandists call the Middle East has not been at war for thousands of years, but their social engineering project, their psychological operation, that's as ancient as the oldest of empires. The greedy few have always set the people against each other with what the Romans called divide et impera, to divide and rule. The war on Islam is a war on you.
Next, we begin with a moment that has rippled across social media, across political circles, and across the fractured landscape of public opinion, a video titled, "I Was Wrong, My Apology for Israel Criticism." It comes from Brandon Tatum, a former police officer turned conservative commentator, a man whose voice carries weight in certain corners of American discourse. And in this video, he does something rare in the world of political commentary. He reverses himself. He steps forward and says he was wrong. He apologizes for his earlier criticism of Israel. He tells his audience that new information, new context, and a new understanding have reshaped his view. And he frames this reversal, not as weakness, but as moral clarity. But now, we are not here simply to replay his apology. We are here to examine what it means when a public figure shifts their stance in real time, under real pressure, in a moment when narratives about Israel and Palestine are being contested, reshaped, and weaponized every single day. Because Tatum's video is not just a personal confession, it is a window into the machinery of influence, the power of platforms, and the emotional weight of public persuasion. In the video, Tatum speaks directly to his followers, acknowledging that many will be disappointed, many will be angry, and many will accuse him of bending to pressure. But he insists that his change of heart is rooted in what he now believes is the truth about Israel's actions and intentions. He describes his earlier criticism as misguided, shaped by incomplete information, and he positions his apology as a necessary correction, a moment of intellectual responsibility. And whether one agrees with him or not, the significance lies in the shift itself. A public figure recalibrating his stance in front of millions, knowing the backlash that awaits. This moment raises deeper questions. Questions about how narratives are formed, how they spread, and how they shape the public's understanding of conflict. Because when someone with a large platform reverses course, it forces us to ask, what changed? What pressures were at play? What information was elevated, and what information was ignored? And how does this apology fit into the broader landscape of voices speaking about Israel, Palestine, and the violence unfolding across the region? Tatum's video has been shared widely, praised by some, criticized by others, dissected by commentators across the spectrum. And in that reaction, we see the tension of our time, a tension between truth and perception, between conviction and correction, between the stories we are told and the stories we are allowed to question. His apology becomes more than a personal statement. It becomes a symbol of how volatile, how emotional, and how politically charged this conversation has become. And so, as we finish this hour, we are not here to judge his apology. We are here to understand the landscape that produced it, a landscape where narratives shift overnight, where public figures are pulled between loyalty and scrutiny, where the pressure to conform can be as powerful as the pressure to resist, where the truth is often buried beneath layers of politics, identity, and fear. Tonight, we explore how voices rise, how voices bend, and how voices break under the weight of public expectation. We explore how commentary becomes confession, how confession becomes content, and how content becomes part of a larger struggle over meaning, morality, and memory. And we ask what it means, not just for Brandon Tatum, but for all of us, when the story of Israel and Palestine becomes a battlefield of its own, fought not only with weapons, but with words. This is This Week in Palestine. And now we begin with a question. When someone says, "I was wrong," what does it reveal and what does it conceal? Let's listen to Brandon.
I'm here to offer a public apology for my criticisms of Israel. I'm deeply sorry. This is a learning moment for me, and I'll share with you the 6 lessons I've learned from my grave mistakes. But first, here's my full confession and apology. I've made videos recently erroneously criticizing the Israeli government, and while there was plenty of agreement with my perspectives, there was also some rageful backlash. And I took note of the many hostile comments insulting me, calling me a Jew hater, an anti-Semite, smearing my character. And those comments have completely changed my mind on the topic of Israel. Quite frankly, the intimidation worked. I realized I was being an anti-Semite, full of hate, and I now fully support the government of Israel. I'm sorry for everything I've said. Sincerely, I was wrong. But here's what surprised me. I took painstaking efforts to deceive you, the viewer. In my videos criticizing Israel, I would carefully put in nuance to draw the distinction that I wasn't talking about Jewish people or citizens of Israel, while clearly stating I was talking about the government of the country of Israel. Like this. By the way, if you're sitting there going like, this isn't a look at citizens of Israel, this is a look at the Israeli government. But so-called haters like this saw right through that and knew that I was talking about Jewish people. The very people I wasn't talking about and deliberately said I wasn't talking about, not only that, but they rightfully pointed out that I hate Jews. My only question to these commenters is like, how could you tell? That's what I was, because I tried so hard to hide it. And other helpful comments like this one helped awaken me from the Jew hate I had just fallen into. F*** you, you f***ing moron. There's 57 Muslim countries, we can have one. Go f*** yourself. It occurred to me a person like this is excellent at spotting hate because she clearly has none of it inside of her, and she correctly spotted it in me. These types of comments were very effective. They typically involved hostility, character smearing, insults fueled by anger. In other words, they're the loudest people screaming. And that might make you think that if you don't agree with them, then you're in a small, shameful minority of people. But according to this poll, they're actually in the 5.5% minority of people. What does that tell you? Well, it tells you that 94.5% of people need hostility and emotionally charged insults thrown at them so they can be convinced to think like you. Just like I was. I mean, my realization was like, look at the behavior of these people calling me an anti-Semitic sack of shit. What do they believe? because I want to be just like them. And realizing that they have the exact same perspectives as Lindsey Graham gives me a good principled man to set my sights on to emulate. And even though people like say it, I honestly don't think Lindsey Graham is gay. Side note, I also noticed that most of the haters had Israel flags in their bios. And just to clarify, when people were doing that with Ukraine, saying Ukraine's our greatest ally, we know it was just people falling for anti-American propaganda. But with Israel, it's different because Israel is our greatest ally. And I stand with Israel. At least I do now. Now, before I get to the very humbling lessons I've learned, I want you to know that I recently sat down with two of my closest friends who are Jewish. Here's what I said to them. I apologize for hating you guys. They said back to me, how have you been hating us? I said, well, I've been openly criticizing Netanyahu and Israel's government, and I've learned that's really me hating you Jews. And they said, no, it's not. We have family in Israel and they hate Netanyahu. They went on and said, according to polls in Israel, only 40% of Israelis trust Netanyahu. They're really frightened by the guy and how he runs things and the direction he's taking their country. So I said back to them, I don't think that matters because citizens in the state of Israel are God's chosen people and Netanyahu is their leader. And they said, well, you've obviously been indoctrinated with dispensationalism and Zionism. Prior to those made-up ideologies, there were completely different interpretations for what Israel and God's chosen people meant in the Bible. And I said, I don't think that matters. But they just wouldn't listen to me. They said, besides, if God was referring to literal Middle Eastern Israelis, a ton of people in Israel don't have that DNA because they come from Europe. That's why DNA tests are outlawed in Israel, aside from some medical and legal testing exceptions, because they don't want people to know. And I said back to them, God, I hate you people. And there it was again. Then they called me gay and didn't accept my apology because they weren't convinced that I actually hate them. This one's insightful. J.P. Sears saw how much money Jew hating makes, so he decided to join in. Remember, retards like J.P. look at this map and think Arabs are the victims. Dude, I have become very wealthy from Jew hating. But, like, how did they know that? I don't even know how I'm going to earn money anymore. Do you think I'm a retard? Yeah. Oh. Now, with my apology, I'd like to offer the lessons I've learned from my mistakes in hopes that others can learn from them too. Lesson one, you should be aligned with the side that's doing the censoring. Because prior to my video called, Hey Man, What's Zionism Being Censored from YouTube? I wasn't. And now I am. And you should be too, because censorship is known for being on the right side of history. And please do support your politicians who are actively trying to pass bills making it illegal to criticize or boycott Israel. Lesson 2. I've learned that distrusting any government makes you a stupid sack of shit. I mean, if you're not in lockstep with the persistent narrative and talking points of the government because your senses and thinking tells you something else, then you hate Jews. Lesson 3. I've learned that when there's tribalism, intimidation tactics being used, threatening to outcast you from society by destroying your reputation, Jew hater, anti-Semite, etc., you want to immediately comply and fall in line. Acting out of your fear of not belonging aligns you with truth and really gives you more freedom as an individual. Lesson 4. I've learned that Israel in no way has influence over the US government or US politicians. And the politicians that are funded by the Israel lobby AIPAC, which the ones in red are, it's not an indicator of those politicians being influenced by the lobby that pays them. And it is indeed anti-Semitic to think that there's any level of connection there. Lesson 5. I've learned that thinking it's a crime, let alone evil, to commit genocide, prisoner rape, or killing children is not only not true, it's anti-Semitic to think so. Lesson 6. I've learned that we need to do whatever it takes to fight an ongoing war with Iran, and it has nothing to do with Israel. If you think it does,
Jew hater.
The truth is, our government says we need to, and we should trust that. And perhaps while we're over in Iran, for as long as it takes, we could scoot over to Iraq and finally find those WMDs that we're told they have. So with my apology, I hope you can learn from my mistakes faster than I did. With all of that, once again, I'm sorry.
And now, we turn to a video that has shaken audiences across platforms. This Gaza fact will sicken you. Media covers it up. Hosted by Owen Jones, a British journalist, author, and commentator known for challenging establishment narratives and exposing the failures of mainstream media. In this episode, Jones confronts a reality so staggering that he argues it would dominate every front page on Earth if it happened anywhere else. He begins with a haunting comparison. Imagine an entire extended family. Grandparents, parents, uncles, aunts, teenagers, toddlers, even newborns. Wiped out in a single act of violence in a country like Britain. He explains that such an atrocity would be remembered as one of the greatest crimes of the post-war era, a national trauma etched into history. But then he turns to Gaza. A territory with just over the second 1.2 million people, and cites a study from Al Jazeera reporting that more than 2,700 Palestinian extended families have been erased since the assault began in October 2023, entire bloodlines removed. From the civil registry, their memories and histories extinguished as though they never existed. Jones emphasizes the scale of this loss. The youngest victim, a 1-year-old baby, the oldest, a 101-year-old man. Each family carried its own stories, traditions, secrets, joys, and heartbreaks, all gone. He argues that if such a crime occurred anywhere else, especially in a population this small, there would be no debate, no hesitation, no controversy about what to call it. It would be universally recognized as genocide. Jones uses this episode to highlight what he sees as a profound moral failure in global media coverage. A refusal to confront the scale of destruction. A willingness to sanitize or obscure the reality of what is happening to Palestinian families. He challenges viewers to consider how differently the world reacts, depending on who the victims are, and how silence, distortion, or selective reporting can shape public perception. He argues that the erasure of these families is not just a statistic, but a deliberate act of forgetting. A way of making the loss easier to ignore. As a host, Owen Jones brings his characteristic urgency and moral clarity. Known for his books Chavs and the Establishment, and for his critique of media systems that punch down, not up, he uses his platform to amplify stories he believes are being buried or distorted by mainstream outlets. His podcast, hosted on Acast and shared across major platforms, positions itself as a countervoice to what he describes as a broken media landscape, one that too often fails to hold power to account. In This Gaza Fact Will Sicken You, Jones is not simply reporting a statistic. He is sounding an alarm. He is asking why the world is not reacting with the same horror it would if these families lived anywhere else. He is asking why the deaths of thousands of Palestinians, entire family trees, are treated as footnotes rather than front-page tragedies. And he is asking what it means for all of us when the erasure of human lives becomes normalized, minimized, or hidden behind euphemisms. So now, we bring this story into our own space, not to echo outrage for its own sake, but to confront the scale of loss, the failures of coverage, and the moral responsibility of those who witness and those who speak. Let's listen to him.
Imagine one extended family was violently killed in Britain, which has a population of around 69 million people. The grandfathers, killed, the grandmothers killed, the fathers, the mothers, the uncles, the aunts, the teenagers, the toddlers, the newborn babies, all killed. One extended family gone, murdered in Britain. If that one extended family was killed in Britain, it would be regarded as one of the great crimes of the post-war era. This horror would be splashed on every front page. It would lead every news bulletin. We would have in-depth portraits of every victim. We would see the smiling faces of the photos of children and babies killed in this horror. Politicians would do grief-stricken speeches. Social media would abound with ordinary citizens sharing their disgust, their horror. It would go down in the history books, a crime remembered with shock for generations. Gaza had a pre-genocide population of around 2.2 million, much smaller than Britain's 69 million people. According to a new study from Al Jazeera, Israel has wiped out more than 2,700 Palestinian extended families in Gaza since the genocide began in October 2023. The youngest victim killed in Gaza by the Israeli state, a one-year-old baby. The oldest victim, a 101-year-old man. Each family, their own memories, their own histories, their own traditions, their own secrets, their ups, their downs, their celebrations, their tragedies. All of these families, gone, erased from the earth, as though they didn't exist in the first place. All those precious shared moments that they had, a child's first word, family celebrations, days out on the beach, all of these families wiped from Gaza's civil registry, all of their memories wiped along with them, as if they never happened. If anywhere else on earth, especially in a territory with just over 2 million people, 2,700 plus extended families had been violently exterminated in the space of 2 years, there would be no debate or discussion or controversy about whether that this constituted genocide. It would be deemed outrageous to even deny it. It is our responsibility, not least in countries which helped arm and facilitate this genocide, to remember all the details of what our countries helped do to the people of Gaza. Let's listen to this from Al Jazeera.
This isn't only a story of casualties. This is a story of lineage, heritage, and identity disappearing in an instant. For that to happen, three generations of the same household must be wiped out. More than 20 members of a Najjar family were killed that night. Sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, so many branches gone.
More than 2,700 families were completely erased, with a total of more than 8,000 deaths. About 40,000 families were targeted, which means more than 4 deaths in each family.
When a Palestinian family disappears, they take with them their history, their traditions, their memories, and their future. Names that would have lived on for generations have vanished from Gaza collective identity. Names that define a genocide. Hani Mahmoud, Al Jazeera, from Gaza City, Palestine.
As well as every single member of 2,700 plus extended families being wiped out, there are another 6,000 families with just one survivor remaining. Imagine being that sole survivor, the only one remaining from your bloodline. Maybe some of them are young, able to have families, keep their bloodlines alive. Others will be older, knowing that when they are gone, no one will remain from their bloodline. The last of their clan walking the earth, knowing that when they die, maybe when they are bombed or shot or starved or die of a treatable illness, their bloodline too will be erased from Gaza's civil registry. Israel's genocide has not stopped. According to the figures, at least 477 Palestinians have been killed since the so-called ceasefire began in October, with another 1,300 injured. Imagine just one Israeli civilian had been killed by Hamas in that time. That one civilian would lead our news bulletins and be splashed on front pages, and there would be fiery condemnations from politicians and pundits. It would be offered up as evidence of the unique evil and barbarism of Hamas. The ceasefire would be declared over, and Israel would use it as an excuse for even more violence, though as we can see, they hardly need a pretext. Last Wednesday, for example, the Israeli army killed at least 11 Palestinians in Gaza on one day, including two 13-year-old boys, three journalists, and a woman. Now, of course, during the full-scale genocide, hundreds were being killed each day. But these are still human beings. And if 11 Israelis were wiped out in one day, in different incidents, by Hamas, just imagine. One of those 13-year-olds was killed alongside his father and another 22-year-old man. The other 13-year-old, named Motassem al-Sharifi, was killed as he collected firewood. Here's his father weeping over his body. Again, just imagine one 13-year-old Israeli civilian. One 13-year-old Israeli boy had been killed by a Palestinian militant as they went about their daily business. Imagine the outrage, the uproar, the coverage, the denunciations. But I would imagine for most of you, this is the first time you've heard of this Palestinian boy. It will almost certainly be the last. According to UNICEF, Israel has attacked Gaza on 92 of the 100 days of the ceasefire that took effect on October the 10th, the so-called ceasefire. A ceasefire, which means, as the phrase goes, from Israel's perspective, you cease, we fire. Of the hundreds killed, over 100 are Palestinian children. That is three times the total number of Israeli children who were killed on the 7th of October. And yet there was more outrage over the fictional, non-existent, made-up beheading of Israeli babies than there has been over a single Palestinian child killed by Israel. The tens of thousands of Palestinian children, their lives treated as though they didn't matter. But they do matter. The children who survive are living through unimaginable trauma. Listen to this from UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram.
We estimate that every single child in the Gaza Strip, 1 million, needs some level of mental health and psychosocial support. And we are providing that now, and we want to scale it up. And we want to do that in the classroom so that as we're getting children back to learning, we're also providing mental health support for them in that environment. But I've seen it firsthand, the scale of the needs and just the intensity of some of the symptoms that children are exhibiting, children who don't speak anymore or don't eat because of what they've endured. It's going to take, you know, concerted, I think, effort and many years for some of these children to overcome what they've been through.
As she says, every single surviving child in Gaza needs some level of mental health support. The trauma they have experienced is beyond the realm of our imagination. They have suffered bereavements. They have watched people be killed, including their loved ones and friends. They have been repeatedly displaced, forced to flee under threat of violence. They may have been injured. They have experienced day after day and night after night of terrifying explosions and bombs going off and bullets being fired, constantly wondering if this will be their last moment alive. They've been sick and deprived of treatment. They have been starved. They've been crammed into tents. They have been denied fresh water, the ability to clean themselves or use toilets. They have been denied schooling. They've been subjected to extreme cold and extreme heat and flooding. We could go on. These children have and are suffering apocalyptic conditions beyond our imagination. Yesterday, the IDF announced they'd recovered the remains of their last hostage in Gaza, a police officer declaring there are officially no more hostages in captivity in Gaza, leaving aside that Gaza's 2 million or so, we don't know how many are left, survivors are all hostages of the Israeli state. There are over 9,000 Palestinian detainees held by Israel. Hostages, many of them neither charged or tried, and if they were, by kangaroo courts, arbitrarily kidnapped and then held in hideous conditions, tortured, starved, denied medical assistance, raped, and indeed killed. And there are hundreds of Palestinian bodies in Israeli captivity. Yes, their bodies being held hostage. This one Israeli police officer and his remains, more anger and horror than countless surviving Palestinians or the tens of thousands of Palestinians murdered, all of course, the bodies of Palestinians who were held in captivity. As the brilliant Palestinian analyst Mohammed Shahada notes about the Israeli remains that were located, Israel knew for a month the approximate location of Ram Gavili's body in Gaza, but Netanyahu prevented the IDF from launching the operation to retrieve him. Ram's body was Israel's last pretext to keep Gaza's Rafah crossing closed and obstruct phase two of the Trump deal. You see, Israel simply looks for any excuse or pretext to make the Palestinian people suffer. Now, the Rafah crossing from Gaza to Egypt may well be opened by Israel. But what does this mean? Listen to Palestinian analyst Nour Odeh.
How worried are people that if Palestinians leave Gaza through the Rafah crossing one way, that Israel then won't allow them to come back in? And that goes against the ceasefire agreement, doesn't it?
It does. It's against the agreement. But again, this is what the Israeli government has explicitly said it wants to do. It does not want to allow the large number of Palestinians stuck outside of Gaza to enter. There are no guarantees that those who leave can enter. The thousands of babies who were born since October 2023 have not been registered, so Israel doesn't recognize them. They do not have national ID numbers, and that is another problem that will face those who want to return, who've had children in the past 2 years. So a lot of problems, a lot of hurdles are ahead, and this is a very hot potato, if you will, domestically in Israel. We've already heard from a minister like Itamar Ben-Gvir attacking the U.S. envoy, Steve Witkoff, and calling him naive for wanting to open the crossing, even though the cabinet has already rubber stamped it. But these kinds of ministers, the very right-wing ministers in this right-wing government, will put as many hurdles as possible in the operation of the crossing, how many people are allowed to leave, how many are allowed to come back, who can leave and who can enter. And remember, there are thousands of people who need to be evacuated from Gaza for medical treatment. Those will be the most urgent asks, if you will, of the administration, the new technocratic administration, and of the health sector in Gaza.
It's very clear that Israel, and indeed Donald Trump, have not given up their dream of ethnically cleansing Gaza. That remains their plan, their dream, their ambition. And yesterday, speaking in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, Netanyahu said the next stage is not reconstruction. It is the disarmament of Hamas and the demilitarization of the Gaza Strip. We have an interest in advancing this stage, not delaying it. It is clear that Israel is looking for any excuse to continue leaving Gaza in ruins because they made it unlivable for a reason. They do not want any living Palestinians to remain in Gaza. Meanwhile, the brilliant Dropsite News have a report on the so-called Board of Peace, an Orwellian term, which is led by Trump, intending not just to rule Gaza, but to have power beyond that and to challenge the United Nations. Trump is emperor with de facto supreme power. A Palestinian body has been created with no independent sovereignty and operating under a high representative, a kind of colonial era viceroy. New appointees include Chief of Staff Susan Wiles and Martin Edelman, a real estate attorney and special advisor to the government of the United Arab Emirates. There are other real estate developers on this board for a reason, because the Trump plan remains. The plan he announced last year, turn Gaza into a holiday resort for the mega rich, with Palestinians gone, where oligarchs can sunbathe on the ground where tens of thousands of murdered Palestinians are buried. It is our responsibility to keep talking about Gaza. This is a crime which is unspeakable in its dimensions. One of the great crimes of our age. Facilitated by our politicians and by our media organizations. Nothing can stay the same after this. There's no returning to normal after this. There is no compromise to be had with people who can facilitate this level of barbarism. They have to be defeated. They have to go to prison. Their careers have to be destroyed. We have a responsibility to fight for justice and accountability, because if we don't, we do not just deprive the Palestinian people of justice, but we normalize endless barbarism. Anything is possible after this. Any level of evil is possible after this, unless
we do something about it, and we hold the architects of this genocide to account. That's up to us. We've got responsibility. Because if we don't, we degrade ourselves. We lose our own humanity. Because we know we will have allowed our rulers and our media to impose unimaginable evil, which we failed to do anything about. It is up to us. Please like and subscribe. We won't stop talking about Gaza and the genocide, of course. Help us take on the pro-genocide media who facilitate this genocide at patreon.com/ownjones84. You make all of this possible. I keep saying, finishing my book, The Fall of the West, out in October, which will all be done and dusted in a few weeks. And then we'll just focus on the channel. We've got lots coming up, including, for example, the Gorton and Denton by-election, which will be held in a month because they were trying to rush it through as quickly as they can. We're going to go up there, talk to people on the ground, see what's going on. Fingers crossed, of course, that the Green Party triumph. I'll go up there and I will, by the way, I will speak to people of different political perspectives and views as a journalist, but I'm always open about what I think, unlike other journalists who pretend they're impartial and then just pursue their political agenda in a deceptive way. I'm always open and honest about where I stand, but I'm also rigorously fair in terms of who I speak to.
And just like that, we reach the closing moments of this week's broadcast. As you step back into your day, carry with you the questions that refuse to be buried, the courage that refuses to dim, and the curiosity that keeps truth breathing in a world that often tries to suffocate it. I'm Bethany Marks, your host and narrator. Sharing this hour with you has been a profound privilege. An hour anchored in clarity, in dignity, and in a solidarity that does not vanish when the headlines shift or the cameras turn away. If something you heard today unsettled you, challenged you, or opened a door you didn't know was there, and if you ever feel called to lend your own voice to this work, know that this space has room for you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult road beside us. And to the remarkable team whose labor keeps this program alive. Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Abby Misri, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Moza, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Juliette Salome Olivier, Renaud Al-Ghul, and our editor, Mohamed Al-Ghul. Your dedication, your steadiness, and your unwavering clarity are the heartbeat of this show. Week after week, you remind us that storytelling is not merely craft. It is inheritance. It is resistance. It is care. It is memory carried forward. This Week in Palestine is produced by Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting for more than two decades from WZBC, student radio at Boston College. If you missed any part of today's program, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radio4all.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine or TWIP and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also featured on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab-American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Visit www.millionpodcasts.com to explore their growing library, including ours. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. This is This Week in Palestine. This is Occupied Land. This is Palestine. And the call for freedom continues. Free Palestine from the river to the sea.